Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and this week a sceptic, a do-or-die sceptic, who went so far as to sacrifice his house in his cause. How many of us would go that far? Ian Plimer fought the creationists on the matter of Noah's Ark, until the precise wording of the law under which he tackled the question brought him undone. Ian Plimer is now Professor of Mining Geology at the University of Adelaide. And Ian, after all that, have you become less sceptical?
No, I haven't. Scepticism forms an absolute basis of science. I'm sceptical about the extraordinary claims that the creationists have made and continue to make. I think in Australia the creationists have taken a step backwards, and I think that's for many reasons. They've really shown themselves to be totally ridiculous and fraudulent, and they're quite comfortable with telling lies and quite comfortable with distorting the evidence. And for them to claim that there's a scientific background to creationism, I think, is an absolute turpitude. And I think we really have to follow their claims in a Socratean style, pretend you know nothing and just keep asking them simple questions, and eventually find that it's really quite vacuous. And the damage they do is not to science. Science is ever-evolving, ever-changing. The damage they do is to Christianity. And I think some of the really outlandish creationist groups have damaged the church immeasurably.
After your rather famous encounter with some of the creationists and some of the people who are claiming, for example, to see Noah's Ark in some shape or form on a mountain, I expected when Intelligent Design erupted over a year ago that Ian Plimer would be to the fore again, but I didn't quite see you there.
No, I wasn't there. I'm moved on a little bit from creationism, but Intelligent Design is so absolutely ridiculous. I mean, why would an omnipotent, omnipresent, all-knowing God create the human shin bone at the level of a tow bar? No God could do that. And Intelligent Design is such an abuse of fundamental science that I think it was seen for what it was very easily, and by many.
Yes, but why didn't you front up?
I made a few public comments, but really, I could see it was so ridiculous. Blind Freddy could see what was happening. I think you made a few comments and a few others did, but it really wasn't as evil, I think, as some of the creationist arguments which were raised 10 years earlier.
Indeed. And so you've moved to Adelaide. What sort of research are you doing here?
I have gone back to Mother. My very first love has been the biggest metal deposit in the world. That is Broken Hill. I'm much closer to Broken Hill now than I ever have been in my life, both physically and scientifically. I've been working on this ore body for almost 40 years, and I think I finally understand how the world's biggest ore body forms. Now, if you ask me in a year's time how does it form, you get a different answer. And this is, to me, the beauty of science. It's never static. It keeps moving. The science is never settled. And I'm getting an enormous joy out of getting inside that ore body and having a three-dimensional view at what happened on that wonderful Tuesday, 1,686 million years ago.
What happened on that Tuesday?
We had a pulling apart of the crust, an injection of molten rock from deep down in the mantle of the Earth. We had a system of circulating hot water leaching out the sediments and leaching out salts from the rocks. And then a final squirt of molten rock came in, the system exploded, fluid went through cracks in rocks onto the sea floor, and there was a dynamic, evolving geothermal system, very similar to what we see in many parts of the world today. So by looking at what has happened in some areas such as the Manus Basin, such as the Salton Sea in the US, we can actually put together the story of Broken Hill. And I think we can see an early Broken Hill forming in Lake Baikal in Russia. We can see that other Broken Hills have formed. And these are quite remarkable processes because they're very much different from what we currently see on the seafloor. They appear to have formed at one time in Earth's history. And that, to me, is one of the great enigmas. Why do you get these massive systems forming at one very narrow time interval? And this we see with many ore deposits. This we see in many places in the world. And I think it's one of the great mysteries. And I think the mystery is solved by looking down very deep into the Earth, where there are connections to the mantle in the Earth, where we suddenly release huge amounts of fluid, and that mixes with other fluids, and by a sequence of rather unusual processes, we end up with a very unusual thing called an ore body.
How big is the ore body in Broken Hill?
When I first started to work on it, it was about 200 million tonnes. After 40 years of work on it, it's now about 400 million tonnes. So I'm a great asset to anyone that's got an ore body. Just get me to work on it
and it grows.
Bigger. It grows. But there's been a lot more found and we've understood a lot more about it. And that particular ore body has actually been the ore body that's changed Australia from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And this happened in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So it's had a profound impact on the economy of Australia. And I think if we found another Broken Hill today, it wouldn't have such a profound effect.
It's a bit
effect.
Like the magic pudding, isn't it? The more you take out, the more it seems.
Well, very much so. And for me, I've taken a lot of science out of there. I've also trained a lot of people there. It's a great training ground because it's one of the most complicated areas geologically in the world, and you need to think as a chemist, you need to think as a physicist, you need to think as a biologist, you need to think as a geologist, you need to think cosmology, and you need to integrate all of this. And that's really what science is about, is being coherent and bringing in pieces of information from all over the world and stitching them together. And that for me has been the thrill of Broken Hill.
Indeed. We started talking about scepticism. Now you're also sceptical about something else, which is, if you like, at the other end of the scale, where very few scientists are involved at all in creationism, maybe 12 in intelligent design. Yet when it comes to global warming, there are probably more scientists involved in that in various aspects. I don't mean simply on big committees. I mean as various specialists in science than almost any other single subject in the history of mankind or investigation. Why are you sceptical about some of the things that are commonly said?
I'm sceptical about many things. Some of the early work I published on Broken Hill I now would savagely criticise, and I do that in the literature, and I think that's extremely important. And for me, science involves evidence, which we get from calculation, from measurement, from experiment, and from observation. And we argue a lot about how we get that evidence, the limitations of that evidence, what that evidence means, can it be validated, and can it be repeated? And that's collecting the body of evidence for science. And then to explain that evidence, we construct a theory. And a theory is a very powerful way of understanding the way the world works. With the hypothesis that we have human-induced global warming, I don't have any problems that we've had global warming, continue to have global warming, and we'll continue to have periods when it's cool and warm. That's what we see when we look back in the past. My scepticism about human-induced global warming is that when we look at history, when we look at archaeology, when we look at geology, when we look at astronomy, we can see that we've had many periods in the past of warming and cooling. These periods in the past have been massive changes in temperature, both up and down, massive changes in sea level, changes up to 600 metres we've had recorded in geology. And so when we look at the history of climate change and then we look at what people are claiming today, it really is very minor. And it's very minor compared with what we see in nature. So I'm firstly sceptical that this is due to human activity. And secondly, I think those who are claiming that humans actually change climate need to explain various changes which we see in our lifetime, in history and in archaeology. We need an explanation. Why did the temperatures decreased between 1940 and 1976 at a time when carbon dioxide was increasing? Why did we have the medieval climate optimum, the Roman climate optimum, the Minoan climate optimum? Why have we got these massive cycles which we see in the sun, and we can tie that in to the new isotopes that solar activity generates, and we tie that in over geological time, over archaeology and over history, and we can see that there's a strong correlation. Now, correlations don't mean very much at all in science.
But let me ask you, when you say that you've got your doubts about the human factor, are these absolute doubts, or do you think the odds are, let's say, 20% or 40%, or do you say it's absolutely unlikely? In other words, 0%.
I think it's extremely unlikely, because when we look at the amount of CO2 that goes into the atmosphere from human activity, it really is quite small compared with the degassing of the ocean, compared with CO2 released from life, compared with CO2 that's released from geological processes, and most of those are not documented in any of the current arguments. And when we look at the amount of CO2 that's released from volcanic activity, now we are in a period of quiescent volcanic activity, and one massive volcanic fart can really completely change the whole chemistry of the atmosphere.
Well, it's not my position, of course, to argue the evidence, because I'm a humble science journalist, and the person who should argue that would be an expert in that sort of field. But there are many examples, and one which I saw in Science Meets Parliament, when Professor Amanda Lynch, for example, from Monash, gave some graphs which showed, on one level, the normal input from, say, the sun combined with volcanoes, and high above it was a graph going up, quite separate, which showed the human influence as measured. In other words, in about six different parts of the world, you could show that you can discount both volcanoes and the sun and still get a substantially rising graph. So it seems, in many ways, there are many people who have done the very work you say hasn't shown that sort of effect.
This is where I'm extremely sceptical, because there's a great body of evidence showing the amount of carbon dioxide that's released by natural geological processes. Now, the ones which are not discussed when people are talking about human-induced climate change are things like earthquakes. We have some 10,000 significant earthquakes every year. Every time you break a rock, you release the three main greenhouse gases: water vapour, which is the main greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide and methane. That process goes on. That process we know from measuring fluid inclusions in fracture-filled material in fault zones. That's never mentioned in the arguments. We never
But they say it is.
Definitely not. It is the volcanoes that are mentioned. No other geological processes are mentioned. The other major geological process is one of swarms of earthquakes in mid-ocean ridge areas. Swarms of earthquakes herald the rise of molten rock in mid-ocean ridges. That releases a huge amount of gas into the oceans, most of which is dissolved, so we don't measure that in the atmosphere, and it can be later released into the atmosphere with currents moving and temperatures changing. And that may well actually give us a correlation between earthquake swarms, the rise of melts, and El Niño-La Niña phenomena. So I think my scepticism derives from the fact that if you ignore history, which we are doing, then to understand the present and the future, we're doing very much at our peril. And the arguments we are being bombarded with information that humans are changing climate can only be valid if we ignore astronomy and if we ignore geology. And I argue that these arguments are not scientific, because science is coherent, that a scientific hypothesis needs to be coherent with evidence from all quarters, and that evidence has to be validated.
Sure. Well, let me give you a few examples of the sort of authority, scientific authority, that is on the other side, which is overwhelming. And you've got eight academies, including the Royal Society. You've got some of the representatives, such as those from the Australian Academy of Science, who's the president and the former president of the Royal Society of London. There's a very interesting two-page article written in April in the Times Literary Supplement, where Robert May looks at six books, or seven, in fact, that go from Nicholas Stern's to Al Gore's, Tom Lovejoy's, George Monbiot's. But his article, in fact, is a summary of, if you like, some of the evidence. Now, what he says is, just two short quotations: despite the growing weight of evidence of climate change, along with the growing awareness of the manifold adverse consequences, there remains an active and well-funded denial lobby. He says it shares many features with a lobby that for so long denied that smoking is the major cause of cancer. Now, this is Robert May, who is the president of the Royal Society of London, and in fact the chief scientist to Tony Blair, and in fact an Australian. And he goes on saying, the plain fact is that, as shown in a recent study of the 1,000 or so papers on the subject published in peer-reviewed scientific journals in recent years, not one denies that climate change is real and primarily caused by us. The authority seems overwhelming.
Firstly, scientific authority is no authority at all. Science is married to evidence. And
yes, but he's reviewing the evidence. He's saying 1,000 or so papers on the subject.
Well, we'll come to that in a second. Whether we have an overwhelming number of people that have a different view doesn't really count. It is the evidence that is important. You would be very hard pushed to find a large number of geologists who would argue that humans are creating modern climate change, because in geology we've seen massive climate changes. We've seen sea levels go up and down like a yo-yo. No one has any problem with climates changing because they've always changed. I'd have a real problem if climates didn't change. What has to be demonstrated, which hasn't been demonstrated, is that any of the very slight changes that we can measure now are actually not natural processes. These are related to human activities. Now, I find it fairly difficult when someone claims that there's an active, well-funded lobby. Firstly, the basis of science is scepticism and evidence. There's certainly no funding that anyone I know receives for expressing their sceptical view. And to compare it with the anti-smoking lobby, I think is quite misleading.
Well, there was a documentary that was made by the Canadians shown on Four Corners, I think, a couple of months ago. Did you see it?
I saw it. I thought it was appalling.
Why?
Because I thought it was grossly unbalanced, and it certainly was bad journalism in that the view given was a predestined view, and it reminds me very much of looking at creationist documentaries and creationist films, where they had a predestined answer, and it was how they cut their evidence to do it. Now, in terms of the thousands of papers in peer-reviewed journals, that again is misleading. There are thousands of papers in the geological literature that show massive climate changes, massive changes in Earth history, which are totally unrelated to human activity. And again, this is a very, very selective use of the information. And I would argue that if you need to argue that humans are changing climate, then you narrow the field. You narrow it down to the last 50 or 100 years. If you take a holistic view of the Earth history, then archaeology and then history, you would be very, very hard pushed to argue that the slight changes that are now recorded are anything else but natural changes. Now, if humans are changing it, it's probably only static in the line, which we may or may not be able to measure at this stage. I'm sceptical when people want to use authority, and we saw it with the creationists. They've used the authority of God. And in many ways, I think what we're seeing today with this movement of human-induced climate change is a wonderful religious political movement, which is frightening people witless. And again, it just reminds me of the way the creationists performed.
Well, Robert May, of course, is Lord May, and he's as close to God as you can get while still being planted with 2 feet on Earth. But I don't think he'd last very long if he was distorting the evidence in ways that you suggest. I mean, there are an awful lot of fellows of the Royal Society and an awful lot of papers that they're actually reviewing. And one of the people who has vouchsafed some of the evidence is Lord Oxborough, who's a very interesting person. Do you know Ron Oxborough?
I know Ron.
Yeah. Well, he used to be head of an oil company, and he used to be head of Imperial College. And the way he summed it up was, of course, it has happened before. The temperatures have gone up and down and there have been massive changes, but not at this rate.
Well, 2 points on that. The second thing is that we have had massive climate changes in historical times over a period of 2 decades. The change from the medieval climate optimum to the Little Ice Age took 2 decades, and that was a huge change. And that was a time when Greenland had barley, it had cattle, the temperature was at least 6 or 8 degrees warmer than the current global temperatures. And so if we're to explain our current slight global warming, which has happened since the end of the 19th century and then went down from 1940 to 1976 and then up again, we have to look at that.
So you're suggesting this particular one, the where the temperature went down, and you're talking about this medieval period. Now, Professor Ruderman said that if you link the effect of the plague, where half the population of Europe was wiped out, well, civilization, not an industrial revolution because it hadn't happened yet, but you can show that the reduction of the effect of the number of people had a very quick effect on the temperature and indeed the climate. Have you examined that part?
The change from 1280 to 1303 was profound. That was followed by the freezing of the Gulf of Bothnia many times. It was followed by famine. It was followed by civil unrest, and finally the plague attacked a weakened population in 1347 to 1349, and the Northern Hemisphere took 250 years to recover and get its population back to what it was. That was a climate-driven phenomenon, and that was driven by global cooling. We saw the same at the beginning of the Dark Ages. It was driven by global cooling.
Well, Ruderman and we had the plague, it's the other way around. In fact, the population went down, the effect was less of people, and therefore you had a lower temperature.
Well, That's contrary to what we see from a lot of the proxies. It's contrary to what we see in the literature, and it's contrary to what we see in the geological literature. Now, just because there's a correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature, which there is not, there is from 1976 onwards, doesn't mean it's a causation. In the 20th century, we've seen a massive increase in piracy in Southeast Asia. We've also seen an increase in temperature. You correlate the two and you can say, well, piracy in Southeast Asia has driven up temperature. Now, that's not a causation. So correlations in science are meaningless. You need a causation.
Are you suggesting that the papers being quoted here and the fellows of whatever societies are doing something on that kind of puerile level?
I'm saying that as a scientist, I'm sceptical about everything I read in the literature. I'm sceptical about the way the data was collected and the conclusions based thereon. In the geological literature, we see evidence of rapid climate changes. We see evidence of climate changes driven by extraterrestrial, solar and earth processes. And until we can separate the very slight changes that we've measured in the 20th century from what has been happening naturally, then I don't really think we can argue that humans are creating a climate change. Now, again, we've had a massive increase in carbon dioxide in previous times geologically, where we've had temperatures change very slightly, but carbon dioxide go up to 5% in one geological time and up to 20% in another time. So that change is very significant compared with the changes which we're getting in parts per million. I would like to see it demonstrated that what we're seeing today is related to events that are not solar, events that are not related to orbital phenomena, events that are not related to ocean currents moving, events that are not related to cosmic activity, events that are not related to increase in volcanism or change in the shape of the sea floor, because these have driven past climate changes. And again, I stress that unless we understand the past, which it appears we're not willing to, then we've got no chance of understanding the present. And the current alleged debate, and it's not a debate, on climate change has totally ignored history, archaeology and geology. And therefore we're getting such a biased view of the literature that I don't think we're dealing with science.
Now, if you're right, we don't have to worry and we'll have to adapt to what's going to happen anyway because nature is changing, whether we like it or not. On the other hand, if it is us and we've got a short amount of time, as many people have said, to do something about it. How relaxed are you about the risks that we might be taking by ignoring some of the evidence that most scientists seem to adhere to?
We had a scare with the Y2K. The end result of that was that we cleaned up our data management systems and we cleaned up our computers. And I think that was very good. It cost us a lot of money and it was probably a problem that didn't exist. I think we have a very similar problem, a problem that may not exist. The end result of that is that every person now is very much aware of what they put into the atmosphere and what they put into the waterways and their consumption. We are also, I think, facing something which we should have faced a long time ago, and that is how do we use energy? And I think we are cleaning up our act in terms of energy efficiency. So whether we have a human-induced global warming, which I think is highly unlikely, or the natural cycle where we're coming into cooling, which is much more likely, I think this has been very positive in that we've had to address how we use energy, and we are extremely inefficient users of energy. The energy that developing nations use is much less per capita than what we use. That is changing very, very rapidly. So I think it requires us to have a great look at how we live as Westerners in a very comfortable Western life.
So the response people are talking about is a good thing?
I think to think about it is a good thing. Some of the suggestions, I think people should be adding ice blocks to their drinks.
Ian Plimer, Professor of Mining Engineering at the University of Adelaide. And there will be more on all that, as you may know already, on ABC television next Thursday, when the great global warming swindle film is screened with a discussion afterwards on which you could well see present company appearing. I'm Robin Williams. Keep cool.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.